From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why some working parents are finding the office more fulfilling than life at home. We talk with Arlie Hochschild. Her new book, The Time Bind, explores how working parents are balancing life at work and life at home. Also, why college costs so much. We talk with Ann Matthews, author of Bright College Years, inside the American campus today. TV critic David Bianculli looks at tonight's final episode of Roseanne, and rock historian Ed Ward examines an earlier era when bar songs celebrated the inebriating effects of alcohol. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most common complaint I hear is this: there doesn't seem to be enough time for work and a life outside work. This is a particularly frustrating predicament for working parents who feel they're damaging their children by not spending enough time with them. Newsweek and U.S. News & World Report had cover stories on the subject this month. Each referred to a new book by my guest Arlie Hochschild called The Time Bind. Hochschild did a study of employees at a Fortune 500 company known for its family-friendly policies. She keeps the company anonymous, referring to it only as Amerco. It's an old cliché that men often seek refuge at work from the demands of the wife and children at home. Hochschild reports that's still true. What's changed is that now many mothers are also seeking refuge at work from the demands of family life.
Well, let me say at first that they didn't think they wanted to get out of the house. That, in fact, women are felt like they were just getting through the day. You know, it's not something they were thinking about. But when you ask them, where is it you feel appreciated? Where is it you feel really seen for your contribution? Where is it you feel good at what you're doing? And where are your friends and your social supports? They would often answer, at work. It's as if the village had gone to work. And when you ask them what it was like being at home, they would often say, God, there's a lot to do. One woman, for example, said, I come home and put the key in the door, and one child hasn't talked to anybody all day, another, the baby isn't in bed, the dishes are in the sink, and her husband has kind of felt like he was babysitting. He was waiting for her to come home, and as soon as she was home, it was all her job. And she didn't feel appreciated. She didn't feel valued. There weren't any recognition ceremonies for her at home. So it wasn't something that people were intending. It wasn't something that people were really conscious of. It wasn't a sort of a way of seeing family and home life that I think we've been aware of before. But this was a theme, that home had become a kind of a workplace. And for some of the people, some of the time, work had become a little bit of a home.
What were some of the things about work that made it seem more like home? And also, what were some of the things about work that made some people feel like they got more rewards, that work was the place where they felt more self-confident, that work was the place where they had an affirming network of people?
Well, this depends a lot on the workplace. It's not every workplace that's heaven, but it also depends whether you're a manager, a clerical worker, a production line worker. But among managers, at a lot of Fortune 500 companies, there are new motivational programs, a total quality program, for example, that talks about valuing the individual and delighting the internal customer and so on. And there are a lot of recognition ceremonies and teams. You work in teams. So that the company actually thinks a lot about trying to make workers feel good. You know, they have gyms at work. As I see, this is a kind of an elite picture, but it created a kind of a managed atmosphere, that kind of managed cheer that was a relief to a lot of people. And even if people didn't like the content of their jobs, they had kind of lousy production level jobs, their pals were there, their flirtations were there, their friends were often there to talk in the break room with, have a beer after work with.
An interesting point you make, you say with so many marriages breaking up, it even seems that you can get your pink slip at home. Home doesn't mean security in the way that it once did.
Yeah, it's quite right that for a lot of the workers at this company, they'd been working at Americo, the company I was studying, for 10, 15 years, but they were on their second or third relationship or marriage, so they were getting their pink slips at home.
Let's look more specifically at the company that you studied, that you based your conclusions on. It's a Fortune 500 company that you gave a pseudonym to protect their identity.
Right.
Tell us something about the company and the policies, the work-home balance policies that they initiated, which you studied.
Well, the reason I went to Americo was because of these policies. It was a vanguard, family-friendly company that offered paternity leave. It offered a part-time work with benefits and either temporary or permanent, offered job sharing. Two people could share one job, three people could share two. It offered flex time. You could come early and leave early or come late and leave late. It offered flex place. You could work from home part of the time or all the time. So those were the policies that were on the books. And one of the big surprises and paradoxes was to realize that a lot of the families that I interviewed were working very long hours and needed time at home. And these were people with strong family values who wanted some balance in their life, were somehow shy about coming forward for these policies. And so that was kind of the what I didn't expect to find going in, but got haunted by and interested by coming out. You know, why? What was the obstacle in the way of achieving some kind of balance between work and family? You know, why was this not working out in a company that seemed to promise good news on this score?
Do you think sometimes that although some companies will put policies into place that make it seem like you can work more at home or take more flexible hours, that the company might also at the same time really underestimate what it takes to do your job in an adequate way? And so, in a way, they might be paying lip service to flexibility, but still requiring you to work really hard and really long hours.
I think you're completely right about that. For a lot of companies, family-friendly policies are a fig leaf on top of a highly workaholic culture from which the company gets a lot of benefit. But I am wondering, you know, where the stormtroops are. Where's the resistance to this? Who's coming forward and saying, you know what, this isn't working for us?
No, I think one of the things that makes an organized movement a little more difficult is that if you're talking about, say, a 9-to-5 job where you punch in on the time clock, you can say, well, we're working 8 hours and we ought to be working 6. But for a lot of, you know, management type people and, you know, people who have what's defined as like a professional job, you're not on the clock anyways. And it's kind of understood you're not getting overtime because you're a professional. And so you're just going to work as long as it takes to get the job done. And so getting the job done might require working till 10 at night, and you're not even going to get overtime for it. But it's accepted that's what comes with the position that you have, with the responsibilities you're given and the salary that you get. And it's hard to say, well, you want to work shorter hours because the hours aren't defined in the first place.
Right. I think that's right. But what if we work toward a system where someone who has, let's say, small children at home, or they have elder care, or they just want to grow their garden, say, look, You know, for a certain number of years, I want to go to 85%. That's not part-time. I'm not actually in favor of part-time. I'm for redefining what full-time is, mm-hmm. you know, and getting a variety of different kinds of work schedules to be normal.
So what's your interpretation of the reluctance of workers to use these policies that would enable them to spend more time at home?
Well, in addition to all the factors that we've talked about, I think there was one that nobody's been looking at, and that is a cultural shift that the village, in a way, has gone to work, and people's social supports are more now at work, and I guess that cultural shift expressed itself in a lot of different ways in all the interviews that I was doing at this company.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Arlie Hochschild, and her new book is called The Time Bind, When Work Becomes Home and Home Becomes Work. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Arlie Hochschild. Her new book is called The Time Bind, When Work Becomes Home and Home Becomes Work. Your study is based on your observations at a Fortune 500 company, which will remain anonymous. This company had a daycare center so that parents could feel confident that their children were taken care of while they were at work. And it, of course, would enable parents to go to work and to work longer if they needed to. Tell us a little bit about how this daycare center worked and how many hours typically children spent there.
Well, it was a first-rate daycare center. The daycare providers there were well-trained and very responsive to the children. I couldn't think of a better childcare center, in fact. And but the hours were extremely long. Anywhere from 8, 9 to 10 hours. So one thing I did was I hang out at the child care center and watch parents bring their children and leave. And I would see parents come in and wave to the children with their keys in hands. And they would talk very briefly to the child care provider, and then I would see them race for their car as they got out the door. So parents were sort of in a hurry as they dropped their children off at the child care center, and they were at a hurry when they left as well. One got a sense of racingness. And in fact, when I was at the child care center myself, sitting on a little toadstool chair, having just come from my own kind of racy work life with, you know, faxes and email and stuff, I was sort of feeling speedy, and I sat down in this little chair and I saw this little kid putting together a puzzle, and I thought, gosh, you know what, I could do that puzzle in a flash. I just put this little piece here and that little piece there, and I thought, my goodness, Arlie, you know, slow down. What this child is putting this puzzle together and needs time. And I realized that I would have to slow my own self down to a child's pace in order to study the kind of culture of time and speediness of the adult world that their parents were living in.
Well, I think one of your points here, too, is that it must be really hard to go from this speedy, insane world of work to then slow down and be at a pace that a child could comprehend, a pace that a child would work at.
Yes, that's right. There were certain islands of child time in this community. One saw them in a pediatrician's office or at a certain family-friendly restaurant and in parks. But very often at home, a kind of logic of efficiency had taken hold, again, without people thinking about it or meaning it to happen. But there were certain slots of time within which a bath had to be accomplished and a meal eaten and quality time, you know, done. And children were forever protesting these slots of time and trying to get some control of time. Because in a way, what had happened is a cycle had taken place. The more time is pumped out of home and pumped into work, the more starved for time people at home are, which makes life at home more of a strain. And so people go home to more of a strain and are more tempted to spend more time at work, which only makes the cycle go around again.
You say that families are actually following some of the same patterns as corporations now. For example, parents have to become time and motion experts, just scheduling everything, the lessons, driving children here and there, what time a meal is going to be, getting a kid off to school and all of that. And that parents are also starting to outsource some of their responsibilities, yeah, like corporations do.
Yeah, what are some of the things that, outsource? Yeah.
What are some of the examples of the downsourcing that you think parents are having to do now?
Well, downsizing, I think the emotional downsizing at home has to do with redefining what our human needs are. You know, what is it? How much time do we really need with each other to have strong, spontaneous social relationships with one another? I think that's getting redefined down, even as kind of the demands at work are being beefed up. So this is one thing. At the same time, parents are tempted to kind of outsource a lot of different elements of parenting. For example, there are ads for experts that arrange your child's birthday party. They send out the invitations, they pump up the balloons, they buy little gifts for the guests, and they sort of do the party for you. And in a way, if you're really starved for time, you're very tempted, if you can afford it, to buy these services. But at the same time, this is yet another subtraction from what we've called family life. And then we wonder why it's hard for families to manage.
One of the things you found when you were interviewing people who work is that they had this kind of imaginary vision that they carried around with them, the person they would be if only they had time to be that person, the family they'd have if only they had time to be that family. What were some of these kind of potential selves, the imaginary selves that people carried around?
Right. This was one way that people evaded the time bind. They didn't really resolve it and try and change their circumstances, but they evaded it by unconsciously, I think, developing kind of potential selves. One man, for example, had bought a lot of camping equipment and this sleeping bags and freeze-dried food, and he had this plan, you know, what a good father he would be to take his two daughters on a camping trip. But that kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed again. And yet he lived with this sense of what a good dad he would be if only he had time. And a lot of the people that I interviewed had camper trucks that they hadn't driven. One had a sailboat, but they hadn't gone out sailing. Some people even had maple syrup making equipment, but they'd never used it to make maple syrup. We normally visualize a potential self as a way of getting in gear to act and get there, but these potential selves were instead of getting in gear to get there.
So just having the symbols around of what your life could be.
Right.
Did you find that those, the camper and the fishing gear and, you know, the maple syrup maker, were there as rebukes to people, objects that would always say, see, you'll never get to use me because you're just too busy? Or did they give any potential pleasure?
Well, they were there saying, gosh, you know, I'm still the kind of guy who has fishing gear. I'm still the kind of guy who has a camping truck. I have a life. And often people would have photographs of these of these objects and themselves in them, the one time they've used them in the last 7 years, kind of on the back, behind them on the wall in their offices, kind of representing an ideal self that they like to think of themselves as, but it was sort of instead of becoming that real self.
The ironic thing here is that you studied a Fortune 500 company that you want to remain nameless to protect their identity, and they had this wonderful program of flexible policies so that people could spend more time at home, although a lot of workers decided not to take advantage of the policies. But anyways, by the time you were done writing the book, the corporation did away with a lot of these policies.
Yes, they did. They did, which shows that it's not actually such a good bargain for people to make work into a home, because it's a business, you know. It's out to make money. It better make a home a home.
But as you point out, people are getting divorced and fighting over custody of the kids. In a way, the picture that you're painting is of no security, no place.
You're talking to an optimist, and I say let's take it from here. And there are a lot of better models out there for the United States to look at. We can look to Sweden, for example, which has paternity leaves that are universally used by men. In fact, half of men take another parental leave in the child's first 2 years. I mean, these things seem amazing to the United States, but here's this advanced industrial nation, Sweden, that for whom this is part of the cake of custom. It's nearly half its labor force are women in substantial jobs, but it's a more family-friendly, child-friendly society. And I kept scratching my head as I listened to these poignant stories of these very good parents whose lives were really out of whack. I kept thinking, gosh, why couldn't we do it like in Sweden? What's stopping us? Maybe it's just not, you know, recognizing quite how far this has gotten. We've tended to normalize this imbalance and think, well, that's what families are like. Gosh, that's what jobs are like. There's nothing we can do about it. A lot of people feel that gosh, there's nothing we can do to change it. And, you know, as someone who's been very active in the women's movement, I have a strong feeling there's a lot we can do to change this.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arlie Hochschild's new book is called The Time Bind. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ann Matthews explains why college costs so much. Also, TV critic David Bianculli says goodbye to Roseanne and praises Mad About You for getting back on track. And rock historian Ed Ward plays bar songs of another era. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pop music and alcohol have gone together since time immemorial, and drinking has been immortalized in thousands of songs. But some classic rhythm and blues songs show that sometimes drinking is more than cocktails by candlelight.
Drunk. 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 It's a mean old bottle they call moonshine. Red, red wine, so mellow and fine. Come home at night with a swimming in the head. Reach for the pillow, miss the whole darn bed. Drunk.
Popular music, until teenagers took it over in the mid-50s, was played in bars much of the time, so it reflected the concerns of its audience, who often had drinks in their hands. For country performers, drinking was almost always represented as a thing to be ashamed of, a sin co-equal with cheating, but rhythm and blues managed to come up with something a bit more ambiguous.
Boy, you ought to listen to your old pappy.
Yes, pappy.
And stop drinking so much.
Well, I ain't doing so much drinking.
Shut up, boy. You drink all day and you drink all night, and son, you know that that ain't right.
Well, Pappy, you just give me a chance, I can...
Shut up, boy. Boy, you're looking thin as a twig.
I know that.
Look like to your dear old Pappy you're about to blow your wig.
I ain't gonna blow my wig, Pappy.
What's the use of getting sober when you're gonna get drunk again?
In fact, R&B drinking songs form a fascinating subgenre of post-war music, although Louis Jordan's What's the Use of Getting Sober dates from 1942. As the music developed in the 40s, some songs outright celebrated drinking.
Whiskey makes you frisky, gin makes you sin, wine makes you nutty, but I'll try them all over again. Cognac keeps you peppy, rum makes you dumb, beer is a mellow drink, but it'll keep you on the run. Whenever you want a drink or two, choose the drink that pleases you. Drink your mash, talk your trash, that is the right thing to do. Latch, champagne makes you happy, vodka keeps you thin, tequila makes you want to fight, but I'll try them all over again.
Roy Milton's Bartender's Boogie is a virtual catalog of folk belief about the properties of various drinks, and even includes such esoterica for the times as vodka and tequila. And another celebration by Stick McGee provided Atlantic Records with its very first hit in 1949.
Drinking that mess, their delight. When he gets a rump, start fighting all night, knocking down the windows and tearing out doors, drinking half a gallon and calling for more. Drinking wine, spooty, ooty, drink wine,
pop, ma.
Wine, spooty, ooty, drink wine,
pop, ma.
Wine, spooty, ooty, drink wine,
pop, ma.
Pass that bottle to me. Hoy, hoy, hoy.
Wine, wine, wine.
Elderberry.
More often, though, alcohol's destructive properties were the subject, although this, too, was often given a light touch.
Whiskey, whiskey on the shelf. You were so quiet there by yourself. Things were fine till they took you down, then opened you up and passed you around. John was the first one to pull you down. He took one drink and he started to clown. Passed you to Hazel, Jane, and Jack. Penelope got you and passed you right back. The doorbell rang and what did you see? In walked Henry, Fred, and Marie. They hit you high, they hit you low, they hit you fast and they hit you slow. Whiskey on the shelf, you were so quiet there by yourself. Things were fine till they took you down, opened you up and passed you around.
Wynonie Harris's quiet whiskey belongs to the party brawl genre that started with Louis Jordan's Saturday Night Fish Fry, but Joe Liggins' Pink Champagne is far more typical.
Pink champagne that stole my love from me. Pink champagne that stole my love from me. Pink champagne, where can my lover be? Champagne, champagne, mellow, mellow wine. Champagne, champagne, mellow, mellow wine. Makes me want to feel so doggone fine.
This number one hit from 1950 shows the double standard well. The couple's drinking has split them up, but it sure is great stuff. In fact, before people started thinking of alcoholism as a disease, you could play it for laughs.
Let me go home, whiskey. Let me walk out that door. Let me go home, whiskey. Let me walk out that door. I've got orders for my baby not to come home late no more. I stopped by.
Amos Milburn vied with Wynonie Harris for the title of Poet Laureate of the Whiskey Heads and recorded a half dozen titles about the amber liquid. One of his most famous songs pictures getting stinko as out and out recreation, in fact.
One scotch, one bourbon, one beer. One scotch, one bourbon, one beer. Please, Mr. Barton, listen here. I ain't here for trouble, so have no fear. One scotch, one bourbon, one beer.
In the song, he mentions that he's drinking because his girlfriend's gone and says, I'm on this kick and I can't get off. But hey, no big deal. Everybody does it. Other versions of the story weren't so pretty. Floyd Dixon's Wino Blues is a study in self-delusion.
I'm just a wino, always wanting to fight. Ever since you walked out on me that night. I call you honey, you thought it was funny, so you walked right out that door. I'll stop going out, won't leave you alone, if you would only come back home. It may seem new, but that I'll do, if you'd only walk through that door.
The poor guy even knows it. Wine will be my death, he sings at the song's end, and you wonder if it's his baby's fault after all. And maybe it's historical perspective, but this 1954 Wynonie Harris record doesn't sound so funny either.
Baby, don't take my whiskey away from me. Baby, don't take my whiskey away from me. You can help yourself to my last dollar. If you touch my jug, you're gonna hear me holler. Don't take my whiskey away from me.
Teenagers, of course, couldn't drink. And although both Pink Champagne and Drinkin' Wine became songs that a garage band just had to learn, the majority of the adult-themed drinking songs faded from view as a younger crowd started buying the records. But I don't want to leave you with the impression that alcohol was the only thing R&B artists sang about drinking. I'll close with a 1955 record by Effie Smith and the Squires. It was a flop, of course, but it was a change of pace.
Give me water, water. Give me water, water.
Don't give me that jive about whiskey and beer. Just give me something that's cool and clear. My best friend thinks I'm a drip. He buys a drink and he sips and sips. Then he starts to run his lip. So give me water without the nip.
Give me water, water.
Ed Ward writes about the history of rock and roll from his home in Berlin. Coming up, why college costs so much. This is Fresh Air. The cost of going to a private college is staggering. Is the product worth the price? That's one of the issues Ann Matthews explores in her new book, Bright College Years, Inside the American Campus Today. Matthews is a journalist who has spent most of her life on or around college campuses. Her father was a professor, and she now teaches at New York University's graduate journalism program. She reports that college tuition has tripled in the past 15 years.
It used to be that you could get a perfectly good education at a public school for about $200 a semester and at a private college for roughly twice that. For most of the 20th century, it was perfectly possible to work all summer and earn enough tuition to get you through the next year, books, expenses, room and board, and tuition itself. And in the last 10 years, all that has fallen away, and now at your average public institution, Berkeley, say, or Illinois or Michigan, any of the flagship campuses, the so-called public Ivies, tuitions are hovering at about $10,000 a year. And at private campuses, regardless of ranking, a Harvard or a Reed, a St. John's or a Middlebury, families are now obliged to go into extraordinary debt. $30,000 a year is not unknown, and some of the large Northeast campuses will break that probably within the next 24 months.
What's behind those soaring prices?
Well, a lot of things, none of them terribly pretty. One is the fact that colleges are now often run like luxury resorts, and students... the student services empire grew enormously in the 70s and in the 80s, and now there's so many extras and frills expected as part of the college experience.
Like what?
Oh, for instance, students expect state-of-the-art computing. They expect state-of-the-art radio stations and television studios. They expect state-of-the-art printing facilities for student papers. They expect excellent music facilities. They expect student unions, which are full of retail operations. It's very rare these days to find a student union or a campus that does not have, say, a Reebok outlet or a McDonald's or a Burger King on campus. And the commercialization of the campus has, in a strange way, raised costs tremendously.
Some college people call the price tags the Chivas Regal effect.
Yes.
What does that mean?
That means that people will pay more for a fancy college label. And if one can go out into the world with Oberlin stamped on your forehead or Harvard or Berkeley, people consider it an adequate investment, more than adequate, worth taking out a third mortgage on your house, worth taking on college loans so extraordinary that they may not be paid off till the 18-year-old's own 18-year-old heads off for college in the year 2030.
So you're saying that often what people are paying for is the pedigree of their degree rather than the quality of the education they're getting?
Yeah, very much so. College has become extremely brand conscious.
Do you have any idea what percentage of money is actually going toward education, and where's the rest of the money going?
Part of it to the student services empire, part of it to the administrative empire. The number of administrators has grown 48% in the last two decades on college campuses, and that means that salaries for faculty get squeezed out and that financial aid gets squeezed out. So a great deal of money on the campus has migrated to the periphery rather than the core, and faculty salaries are not rising nearly as fast as they might. Time spent with students by individual faculty is actually going down. The number of contact hours goes down, and the amount of work that students are expected to do also falls.
You say in your book that about half of all students are walking away from college with huge debts now. It's a lot.
Yes, they are, and people are willing to risk everything because the price of not going to college means a life of poverty and no chance of advancement. The degree has become absolutely necessary.
You say there's a two-tiered system at the universities now. The top colleges could sell every seat many times over, and the other 95% of the colleges can't afford to be selective. Describe more what this two-tiered system is like now.
The name brand campuses are very much in charge these days. And a two-tier universe is clearly forming. 50 or so extremely rich schools and then everybody else, the other 1,500 American campuses. Campuses of permanent abundance and campuses of grinding scarcity is increasingly the norm. Very little middle ground for everybody else. I mean, we're still the world's higher education superpower. And the U.S. is still the great location of second or third or seventh chance learning. You never know when somebody will take to higher education or how or why. And the campus population reflects that these days. Only 1 in 5 undergraduates in America now fits the traditional profile of being under 22, living full-time on campus, attending full-time. The American campus population is increasingly female, adult, part-time, and in debt.
Can you give us a sense of the range of policies you found at colleges on admissions policies for minority students?
Colleges are desperate to have minority students, and they're thrilled when minority students apply.
What do you mean they're desperate to have minority students?
Because the number of minorities applying to higher education is actually falling. And with the affirmative action crises, it's falling faster. So colleges want, passionately want, middle-class black kids, middle-class Hispanic kids, middle-class Asian kids. Someone with the mixed-race student or the mixed-background student is the rage now. If they can pay their way, that's perfect. That's the ideal student. You get into real trouble when you have smart kids with no family assets applying, because financial aid is getting so very tight. It used to be that colleges would invest in poor, smart kids and try to get them through because in the end, they more than repaid the investment. But now, it's increasingly pay your own way.
You say that colleges really prize students who have a mixed ethnic background. Is that because the colleges believe in multiculturalism, or is there something else on the agenda there?
Couple reasons. One is that colleges can get far more federal money if they admit minorities. A minority student is an excellent business proposition. You can get $3 to $5 back in federal funds without ever touching your endowment. if you admit one or if you admit 200.
Is this only if you're a state school?
Yes, yeah. Administrators like that. Another reason to admit minority students is that colleges do have quite a sincere commitment these days to diversity. They've seen it works in their endowment portfolios, and they're coming around to the idea that it works in their student bodies as well.
A lot of people are complaining that academic standards have declined on the campus. Did you find that to be true?
The debate over what an educated person should know is fascinating, but it's also a little off topic because what's really declining is the number of hours that students put into classwork. And in the early, it's quite a striking drop. In the early 1960s, the average student spent about 60 hours a week in class and doing class assignments. These days, it hovers around 29 hours, leaving a great deal of time for students to either get into trouble or work like mad to pay their tuition bills. But for both faculty and undergraduates, college is increasingly a part-time operation, and that's led to enormous changes on the campus.
Are you teaching on the university level now?
I teach in the graduate program at New York University in the Department of Journalism and Mass Communication, and I find that the students are very cautious, very worried about careers, very worried about survival. They've taken on enormous debts. It's a risk as great as any immigrant getting on a ship and coming to America in the 19th century. They've staked everything they own, all their future earnings, on a $40,000 or $50,000 investment in higher education, because many of them are from families that can't help very much. And so, you know, yes, they could ask their parents to take out a third mortgage on the home, but they're often not willing to. And so students are facing the world at 25 or 28 with debts they know they won't pay off till they're 50.
Does that put extra responsibility on your shoulders as their teacher?
Yes, it does. And it's interesting because they're getting increasingly harder to teach. I've been teaching for almost 15 years now, and I find that the effect of television is genuine, especially in the departments where I've taught history, American studies, English, journalism. The students are bright, they're ambitious, and they know the world almost entirely from the screen instead of the page. And so when students aren't from a print culture anymore, it changes the way the university thinks about itself and what it teaches. It's interesting. If you want a shock, you should ask any student at any college to just read a page of 19th century prose. If you want another shock, give them one fragment of dialogue from any episode of Gilligan's Island, and they will identify it perfectly, explain the context, explain the characterization, and explain how it fits into the entire flow of the series and the significance of the director. They're completely visually oriented, and it makes articulation very, very difficult for them. On the other hand, students understand and love computing in ways that the faculty often don't. Except for very, very young or very, very innovative faculty, most college professors are terrified of machinery and they're terrified of change. They often have to have media services come to their lectures to push play on the video. And so you have two cultures, student and faculty, moving apart from each other at much greater speed than any time in the last 500 years.
Well, Ann Matthews, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ann Matthews' new book is called Bright College Years. Coming up, Roseanne's final episode goes up against a special episode of Mad About You. This is Fresh Air. Tonight, after 9 years in prime time, the ABC sitcom Roseanne presents its one-hour finale, directly opposite a one-hour special episode of Mad About You on NBC. TV critic David Bianculli has this review of the two shows.
A year ago at this time, both Roseanne and Mad About You served up series finales that were overly dramatic and threatened to send their shows into new directions. On Roseanne, John Goodman's character of Dan suffered a major heart attack. On Mad About You, Jamie and Paul, played by Helen Hunt and Paul Reiser, threatened to split up. Since that time, Mad About You got back on track, while Roseanne completely derailed. On Mad About You, the Buckmans reconciled, Jamie got pregnant, and the rest of the season has been a big lead-up to tonight's maternity room delivery. Meanwhile, on Roseanne, Roseanne won a $108 million lottery, the Connors split up, and the whole season has been one indulgent disaster after another. For tonight's Roseanne finale, Rosie and Dan are reunited, and their daughter Darlene, played by Sarah Gilbert, is bringing home her baby from the hospital. This allows the extended family to do a lot of nesting and reminiscing. As in this scene, when Dan goes through a box of old baby clothes with his sister-in-law Jackie, played by Laurie Metcalf.
See? It's fun poking through old stuff, ain't
it? Well, we haven't had much fun around here in a while.
Yeah, these are good times.
Mm-hmm. I guess we deserve some. Has been a very weird year.
Yeah, well.
Boy, isn't that the truth. 2 years ago, a final episode of Roseanne would have been big news. But this once excellent show has gone so far downhill so quickly that there's no way to get excited about it. Preview tapes excluded the final 15 minutes, but even that doesn't generate much suspense. Like Picket Fences and Northern Exposure, Roseanne is a wonderful series that lost its way in its final season. Expect it to go out with a whimper. Mad About You, on the other hand, has rebounded strongly from last year's cliffhanger, and tonight's episode is laugh-out-loud funny. It's got a subplot involving guest star Bruce Willis, but that's not what counts here. What counts is how Paul and Jamie relate to one another, and how credible the delivery scene is, even when it's funny. And when Jamie is arguing with her doctor, played by Susie Plaxen, it's very funny indeed.
Jamie, honey, listen to me. Jamie, listen to me. You're completely effaced and dilated. That means it's time to push.
Okay. Now.
Now what?
Now drugs.
Now?
Now.
Jamie, honey, you see, it's too late.
What?
There's a certain window of opportunity during which an epidural can be administered, and in your case, you waited so long that, well, now...
Now what?
The window is closed.
What?
It's closed.
It's closed? Open it.
I can't.
You can't open the window?
The window is closed.
No, 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 open the window.
And it's closed.
Break it! Break the window. What kind of...
With tonight's episode, Mad About You not only delivers a baby, it delivers the goods. In the case of Roseanne, it's better to skip tonight's finale and remember the show in stronger days, when Roseanne was an important working-class sitcom, a strong female voice on TV, and a very funny program.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News and author of The Dictionary of Teleliteracy. The Roseanne finale and the special episode of Mad About You will be broadcast tonight. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman and Roberta Shurrock. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Joyce Lieberman, and Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.